Good morning, honourable members, good morning ladies and gentlemen, and good morning to the staff and all guests present here this morning. Please feel free, this is our meeting, and feel welcome. I would like to welcome all of you to this very important briefing. It is actually a public hearing wherein we will receive submissions and inputs from our stakeholders on the 2016 Division of Revenue Amendment Bill. As honourable members and stakeholders will know, the allocation of resources to the three spheres of government is a critical step in the budget process required before national government, 9 provinces and 257 municipalities can determine so that they can determine their own budget. Parliament provides a national forum for the public consideration of issues and the involvement of the public in the process of Parliament. As you would all know, and as you understand, one of our core businesses is public participation. So this one is in line with our core business. So, but also it is a requirement by the Constitution to entrench democracy. The access to the institution and its members and information provided and received from the public remains a vital focus of Parliament. Very important to consult to the broader society, because whether we want or not, it is about them. So they must say nothing without them. We all know these are indeed challenging times for our economy, and all inputs are most welcome on how best to use the limited resources that we have. Actually, I know the National Treasury will say, do more with less. Have you ever heard of that expression? I learned from the best. Try and do more with less. Okay. Now, honourable members, thank you once more for coming, and you know, to our guests, thank you so much for showing interest in our work. We are looking forward to a constructive and meaningful engagement. Thank you very much.
Good morning, Chairpersons. Good morning, Honourable Members. From the Standing Committee on Appropriations, we have two apologies. One from Honourable Sheikh Imam, who is attending the SADC conference, and Honourable Mahlopa. Thank you very much. What I forgot to announce to this meeting is that this is a joint public hearing on Division of Revenue. The joint meeting of the Select and Standing Committees on Appropriations, and our main area of focus is public hearings on Division of Revenue Amendment Bill, B15 of 2016. Now, which then suggests that I will not be chairing this meeting alone, and I have the chairperson of the Senate Committee on Appropriation from the NCOP as the co-chair of the city. So we will share the chairing part of the meeting. All right, I would like to add an item of the agenda, and we apologize for that, seeing that our guests are not here yet. We were going to do this after, as the Standing Committee on Appropriation. But now that they're not here, we would like to then add on the agenda a submission by a member of this committee on the proposed amendments. The Select Committee on Appropriations, it's okay, you'll be here and observe, but in the main, the Standing Committee on Appropriations will have to participate in discussing the submissions and also assisting in arriving at a consensus on the submissions by a member of this committee. Honourable Member Dr. Peake, let's have that as item number 3, which then we will make number 3, item number 3 to be 4, and then 5, and then 6. So then request Honourable Member Peake to submit to the House, to this meeting.
Thanks, Honourable Chairperson. This submission is in response to a letter from ourselves, myself as a spokesperson and my deputy, Mr. McLaughlin, to submit proposals to the Division of Revenue and the Appropriations. But today we'll be dealing with the submissions to the Division of Revenue both. Before I continue with that, Honourable Chairperson, I just want to make reference to a letter that was the response to the letter that was sent to yourself, where it indicates that we agreed to a program, which we did. We agreed to the program, and specifically to the finalization of the report of the Standing Committee on Appropriations for Monday the 14th. We did. However, there was a request as well to submit our proposals today after a request was made to submit the proposals on Monday. We understand the urgency and the timelines that are the deadlines that we have to meet. So on that, we'd like to make an appeal that in future, that we look at the program to give us adequate time to make these proposals in the light of the fact that we needed to ensure that we receive all the briefings before we submit our proposals. There's also information that we received today which would obviously have an effect on what proposals we submit, and hence my request for that request. So I just would like to make a few points. The letter also indicated that we agreed on that, and we agreed to submit the proposal, but we requested the 14th. And today we still have presentation, public hearing, so it just makes it a little difficult for us. Having said that, I'm going to continue with my submission, and I thank you for that. Yesterday, the presentation by Treasury left a few unanswered questions, Honourable Chairperson, specifically, and we need clarification on that. The first one is, there was an amount of 212 million that has been allocated for the drought relief to the...
Sorry to interrupt you, just as a matter of, I think it's a procedural matter. Do you have the copy so that is circulated to members for easy reference?
What copy is that? What copy?
Copy of your submission, so that as you read, we also...
Well, I'm going to explain that, I'm going to tell you that.
Or you're not going to circulate a copy of your submission?
No, not at this point, no. I won't. I'm going to explain the reason why it was difficult for that submission. Okay, there's clarification that is needed. And the first one, as I indicated, is the 212 million that was allocated for drought relief. And we asked the question to Treasury, which wasn't an adequate response wasn't received as to the rationale behind the allocation, and in the presentation, or rather in the bill, it indicated that it was allocated to 8 provinces. So we just wanted to find out how was that decision arrived at. The second one is a question that was raised yesterday, and again, making it difficult to submit a proposal, is there was an amount of 275 million that was allocated to roads in KZN, and we wanted to know, the money was spent, but when we requested what program, if any, suffered as a result of that money that was spent, all we had is that the money was spent, but roads and maintenance did not suffer as a result of that. But we did not receive an answer, a response as to where that money was used from, unless it was a surplus. And then the other issue that was raised, which would be crucial to the submission of the chairperson, is the 72 million rand addition to the bucket eradication system. While that is welcome, going through the bill, we found that there were 3 major amounts that were removed or taken away from 3 municipalities in amounts of 62 million, 45 million, and 45 million. So based on that, without plausible explanation, it makes it difficult for us to submit the proposal. So, Honourable Chairperson, then today, we received further information today, and that is why, as I said, it makes it difficult to submit the proposal, is we receive information about municipalities that are in distress. Now, again, we don't know what the reasons for that, and it might be that with the information that is received today, that we would have made a proposal to give additions to those municipalities or to propose additions. So based on that, Honourable Chairperson, at this point in time, that's the only submission that we have. We don't have any proposals that we would like to amend the adjustments or the division of revenue adjustments bill, and that will be my only submission at this point in time.
Okay, Honourable Member McLaughlin, I think you are fully represented, or do you have any addition?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just like to support what Honourable Doctor said. So I am going to add to it, but I do support it. Thank you.
All right, honourable members, from the look of things, this submission is directed to National Treasury. Am I right? Fortunately, we have National Treasury in the meeting, and I will then allow National Treasury to respond to the issues raised by honourable member Dr. Peake.
Thank you very much for this opportunity, and I'll answer some of the issues raised, and Stephen will also then deal with some of the issues raised as well. With regard to the drought relief and why was money only given to 8 provinces and not 9 provinces, because we've got 9 provinces for the agriculture, is that there's one criteria that's very critical to meet to receive money through disaster funding. And that is that a province or a municipality must actually declare it as a disaster. How it is done, it is it's gazetted by the province concerned. Although all 9 provinces experienced challenges, Gauteng at that stage did not declare it as a disaster in the province. They have since, after that, has done it. So what will happen going forward is that if the drought continues or we've got other challenges to deal with, because we don't necessarily sit with a drought anymore, we like it with floods as well, it will open a new process as well. So that is the rationale behind it. The Gauteng province is fully aware of it. We presented it as what we call our budget council. The budget council consists of the Minister of Finance, and the MECs of the province concerned as well for finance. And the MEC of Gauteng actually even responded on the issue and indicated that she's aware that the province did not qualify, given that a disaster was not declared. The frequency of the road allocated, gave this morning we gave in a written input. I'll ask Stephen just to go through that written input, but that explains it in quite a lot of detail. Then with regard to the municipality reduction, Stephen will also deal with that one. Then with regard to the list of municipalities that's in financial distress, a number of municipalities are in financial distress not because of incorrect or inadequate funds allocated to them, but rather for them not applying correct financial management procedures. And so the challenges that municipalities experience and what places them in financial risk is often not just a financial issue, but it's also often a governance issue, and sometimes it's also a skills issue. So we cannot take a blanket approach with regard to the municipalities that's on the proposed list or on the list. It is rather an issue of we need to work out a strategy for each and every individual municipality on this list. It also gets done every year. Maybe just to explain how the criteria works. The National Treasury has put down a number of what we call criteria, which we use as a measurement to determine whether a municipality is in financial health or not. So every year we do an assessment based on that criteria, and if a municipality does not meet those criteria, then they fall on the list. And then what we then do, when we've got that list as well, we determine from our side also what is the appropriate support strategy. In terms of the municipalities, what we call non-delegated, which National Treasury monitors, we work very closely with the municipalities concerned and assist them to turn around the situation. And with regard then to the municipalities that what we call as delegated, the respective or individual provinces then is required to do the same as well. So adding additional money just because you're in financial distress could actually create perverse incentives as well, because then every time that you run out of money, you get additional money, and it's actually to the detriment then of municipalities that's very well managed, because they will never receive money, which is then a concern. Stephen, over to you.
Thank you, ma'am. Over to you, sir.
Thank you, Chair. On the question with the rollover for the provincial road maintenance grant in KZN, I think we've dealt with it quite extensively in the written inputs that have been submitted, and we explained yesterday as well that the funds were spent by the province in the 14-15 financial year, 15-16 financial year, at the end of last financial year. However, funds weren't, because the department didn't meet all of the reporting requirements, the Department of Transport didn't make the grant transfer. The funds that were spent from the province's own funds, which I think is what the Honourable Member is asking, and what that resulted in was that at the close of the financial year, there were significant accruals, over 250 million rand in accruals on that department's vote, which then had to be paid in the next financial year using the province's own funds. So if this rollover wasn't permitted, and if the transfer just doesn't go through, then the province will have to find that somewhere in its own budget. At the moment, it's a cash management issue for the province, and as long as they receive the rollover, all the funds will go to the right places. If not, then some other the province would be in a significant financial challenge, and they would have to then look at, as I think the member was suggesting, taking funds from some other program. So I think that is on that issue. On the bucket eradication reduction, there are three large reductions from specific individual municipalities in that grant. Those are all from areas that have the largest projects. And that is, the reasons are different in each case, and we could provide detail, we could ask the Department of Water and Sanitation to provide detail on exactly, on the specifics of each case. Those I don't know, but as I understand it from them, there are delays in those particular projects or changes in the scope of those particular projects that mean that those funds wouldn't be spent in this financial year, and so they are available to move to other projects where the funds can be spent to complete bucket eradication in other areas. Thank you, Chair.
Well, Honourable Member, Dr. Fit, do you have a follow-up question? Honourable Members, other Members, do you have a follow-up question? But I'm sure on this one, I mean, this is information for all of us sitting here. So I don't know if you, I'm sure the Members from the Select Committee can also participate in this discussion. Because why I spoke about us was the decision making was supposed to be, you know, done by. But now I'm opening this up for all of us to participate in this debate or in this discussion. Honourable Member GPA.
Thank you, Chair. This relates to what I said yesterday when we got the briefing on the Division of Revenue and involved regarding municipalities. In the Select Committee for Appropriations on a quarterly basis, we engage with the National Treasury regarding progress made with these stressed municipalities. If we look at the Back to Basics program, there were three columns. Those municipalities in the right-hand column were in the ICU. And that's where appropriations come into to measure the progress. Where are they now? Are they in the middle column or are they in the left-hand side column? That's done on a quarterly basis, and the relevant National Treasury official is Mr. Jan Hartman. That's his job. And it works 100%. Because we've gone through that exercise, and when we go back to our municipalities and our provinces, we take that oversight function further. And a step further again is your own deployment where you are in that municipality. And the AG's findings in the annual report becomes the action plan, which are being monitored on a quarterly basis, what progress is being made, correcting what the AG found in your financial statements, etc., and his findings. So that's how this whole thing fits together.
Well,
Honourable
Member, do you have a question? Honourable Member McLaughlin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, possibly have a question, but it relates to the reply that National Treasury has given us this morning. Yesterday I raised two issues, specific issues out of the adjusted estimates, and the response that the National Treasury has given us here is that it would be more appropriate for National Treasury to respond to those questions when the adjustments appropriation bill is being considered by the committee. But it's exactly for this reason that I asked the questions, because by then we're going to be in the same position we're in now as regards the Division of Revenue Bill. We don't have the time then to take the information we get, put proposals together, and come back to the committee within enough time at the committee for them to be discoverable or discussed and deliberated upon. So if I now have to wait until the Appropriations Bill is before us before I get the answers, again, we're not going to have a chance to submit proposals. I want that information to base my proposals on. But if I have to wait until some future date when it's too late, then there's not much point in it. And I think we have the same problem today with the Division of Revenue Bill. You know, we as the opposition often criticize, as I'm sure you know, that we don't come up with any ideas and proposals. We just criticize and complain. But we feel stymied when we try and do this because we're not given the advance or the leeway to do it. We're not given the space. I know this year we have a particular time constraint because of the Money Bills and Related Matters Act and the
the time frames that are in there, so we are pushed this time around. So I'm also joining Dr. Friedman, asking you, please, in the future, let's try and plan it so that we have actual time wherein we can get the information, sort out our proposals, come back to the committee with them, and be able to deliberate on it before we get to the report stage. Thank you, madam.
I can see National Treasury nodding, meaning they fully agree. Am I right? Taking note and the going process, but they are not opposed to the proposal.
If I can just ask the committee to consider to give us some time to prepare this input, because what we need to do is, particularly given that it's performance information, we need to liaise with the respective national departments as well. So, I mean, we can commit to that earlier, but if you can just get a bit of time to prepare it, but we commit to providing it, saying within a week's time if that is acceptable.
Just another follow-up. But also just to mention in passing that all questions that have to do with the budget adjustment, I think those ones must be submitted in writing, yeah, for a written response. Because I am informed that this unit deals with the DORA, the amendments to the DORA. Am I right? So in all fairness, but those questions we can't postpone, let's take them and then submit them in writing and then we'll submit them for an oral response and then circulate the responses to the member. Agreed? Agreed. Okay. Honourable Member, Dr.
Yeah, Chair. Thanks, Chair. We agree and thank you. We will cooperate as well. What I'd also like to say, at least it's an improvement on past years. At least we have this engagement, we have this opportunity, we've even been given an opportunity to submit a proposal. So it's an improvement and we appreciate that. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Just to mention that indeed one of the democratic principles is consultation and allowing every view to be heard and discussed, but also resolve basing our resolution on majority. Thank you very much. That's fine, and I take it that we have exhausted the question. You see, I'm talking about even yesterday's questions were all responded to, am I right? I can see you all satisfied. I think it means the mission of our engagement yesterday and now this earlier part of the morning has been accomplished. Thank you very much. I'll now hand over to my colleague to chair the meeting on to preside over the presentation by the Rural Health Advocacy Project. Over to you, sir.
No, thanks, Chair. I just want to make an indication that the four chairpersons of both the Finance and the Appropriation Committee met and defined the process of amendments to the money bills. You recall, all of us, that this is an outstanding matter, that we say the tight time frames that impact out of adequate time, particularly also to relate to consultation in provinces to solicit their input. So that process, I think, is going to be firmly one of the critical process of both committees of the two houses to ensure that midway in the coming year that this process is concluded. So it's quite an important thing that impacts on the quality of committees of parliament dealing with the budget process. And then, well, today the chair indicated the public hearing, and we recall that the process started long when the minister presented the medium-term budget policy statement, and part of the bills that were tabled was the division of revenue amendment bill. So the two committees had joint briefing to consider the National Treasury briefing on the bill, and also four parliamentary committees of both houses received the analysis of the parliamentary office on the bill, as well as the MTBPS. And also we had joint committees, we to receive the input from SALGA, which is a very critical stakeholder in the process of formulating the budget. And further inputs from FFC, which is constitutionally mandated to express its view, was also considered. So today is the opportunity for us to listen to interested parties, public inputs, as the chair indicated earlier. I'm deliberately just trying to narrate few of the activities that we have had, because it's a process of having listened much more accurately to stakeholders, very considered views expressed through the process. But most important now is that the next step is going to be where the National Assembly will finalize the bill and refer to us, the National Council of Provinces, and where our committees as well adopt our committee and refer to the House for adoption. But the important step will be for the National Council of Provinces to receive negotiating and final mandate of by provinces before we conclude our process, which will in the National Council of Provinces happen next week on the 18th at Buffalo City, where we'll be receiving the final negotiating mandate. So the rest of other points, I think points are valid in terms of the tight time frames of dealing with the budget. And it's a matter really that is not going to escape our attention moving forward. So we'll be taking our committees on board, even discussing openly areas that require change. So our committee, I'm sure our rural health advocacy project is here. Are we here? The visitors, are they here? Okay. Oh, so it's too close. Yeah, I thought you're part of National Treasure. So I'm... No, thanks very much. Are you alone? Okay, no, this is a very important voice that you must listen as a constitutional state, eh? Democratic state. So we have to listen to you. Are there provincial representatives today in this meeting? Please, very much welcome the provincial representatives who were with us yesterday and today. Much more appreciated. Can I give it over to you, sir, to introduce yourself and then lead us to your presentation?
Thank you, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members, and first thank you for the opportunity to present to the Appropriations Committee on the Division of Revenue Bill today. My name is Russell Rainsberg, and I'm from an organisation called the Rural Health Advocacy Project. Our primary mandate is to advocate for equitable access to comprehensive and quality healthcare by rural populations. You know, as you know, almost 38% of our population live in the rural areas. And a lot of our focus is often on the urban areas to the detriment of people who remain. Because I think in our early years, we generally plan for mass urbanization, but these inequities remain. Our presentation today is in response to the medium-term budget policy statement tabled by the Minister of Finance on the 26th of October. And our presentation reflects on a submission that we made in respect of that statement. And our presentation will focus on two broad areas. The first and perhaps the most important and probably something for this committee to consider is our view on the provincial equitable share revision, both the planned revision and the slight adjustments to the 2017-2018 numbers that the Minister is proposing in the next year to the medium-term budget policy statement. After that, we'd like to probably just reflect on the submission we made last year. And in the second part of our presentation, we'll focus on the impact of any reductions in or any changes to the equitable share in the delivery of services by our provinces in the instance of health. And those primarily focus around the human resource for health crisis, particularly in our rural areas. We have grown our health resources, as Treasury reported, but the distribution of our health professionals still prejudices our rural communities. So, in the medium-term budget policy statement, the Minister lays out two important points for us. The first is obviously the revision of the current equitable share calculation. We all know that the equitable share is is the primary source of revenue for our provinces and some of our municipalities, which lie in the front line of service delivery to our people. You know, the inclusive broadly allocates largest percentages to education, followed closely by health at around 27%, and then there's a 16% adjustment for population. Now, in the medium-term budget statement, the minister proposes to adjust or to update the numbers informing the equitable share based on the 2016 mid-year population estimates, FISAR. Now, as you know, our rural communities, you know, are migrant communities, and we have some provinces that are more rural than others. We think here, for instance, of the Northern Cape. There's the Northwest, there's the Eastern Cape, my home province, and KwaZulu-Natal, but KwaZulu-Natal obviously gets the largest share of the equitable share just based on population.
You must be careful not to rewrite your submission. Members want to influence your submission.
Right, so... yeah, no, thank you. So, maybe just to give you some perspective, but as most of us know, the provinces really, the main source of income is the equitable share, and any revisions or changes to the equitable share is likely to have an impact on service delivery. Now, the current slide is just an reflection of something that most of the members are really aware of, is how the equitable share is allocated, or provincial share of the equitable share is allocated per province, and you'll notice that the largest allocations are currently to KZN and Gauteng, our most urbanized province. In the medium-term policy statement, the minister does make some allowances for any impacts of changes, but these allowances are only for the coming year and they fall away in the following years. But now, maybe just going back to what the minister is proposing, or Treasury is proposing in the division of the equitable share. The first is the population component, adjusting for the mid-year estimates. While we have, I think it's something that we need to consider, like I said, our rural provinces are migratory provinces. You know, our populations are transient, they're moving all the time, and often census data doesn't capture that movement. You know, we just look at people at a specific point in time when we do a census. And it's also well documented that, you know, when it comes to illness, particularly around things like HIV/AIDS, MDR, TB, people tend to go home when they're really ill and they rely on public services to deliver that. And I think when we look at the minister talks about using utilization rates within the healthcare service to determine the health share. Now the utilization rates also just looks at those people that actually get to the hospital. It doesn't really take into account things like lack of access that particularly impacts on the rural communities. So there's a large unmet need that's currently not accounted for. And I think as we're expanding our primary healthcare services through the primary healthcare engineering, as well, specifically things like the ward-based outreach team, which will be driving numbers into the public sector. I don't think this will be accounted for when we look at the utilization numbers that often will probably come back from as early as 2012. In addition to that, I think somebody mentioned the Northwest earlier, there's also an economic activity component within the equitable share. We know that some provinces, rural provinces like the Northwest, is very reliant on mining. You know, over the last while, we've seen a real decline in mining sector employment and growth. And we've seen a lot of people that were previously privately insured now moving on to becoming a burden to the state, something that the minister does mention in the statement, but we feel won't be fully accounted for when we look at those adjustments that are currently proposed for the 2017-2018 budget. In addition, you know, I think it's well documented that developing in our country followed a very unequal pattern in the past. You know, with very significant developments in our more urban areas and a significant underdevelopment of public facilities, you know, rural and underserved areas. And unfortunately, as we moved into our democratic project, that underinvestment in some instances continued. You know, and things like utilization is also based on number of facilities. So where facilities haven't been expanded, you know, I don't think it will fully account for all the people that we need to look for. So, and currently the equitable share formula does not allow for historical infrastructure backlogs in rural settings. You know, additionally, because of the nature of rural populations being quite widely dispersed, you know, the economies of scale existing in Johannesburg or in the city of Cape Town do not. So the same fixed costs are spread over a much smaller population, which essentially pushes up the cost of delivering service. And I think if you use cost-effective approaches or capitation approaches like population data, we don't take into consideration those nuances or variations that are brought about by the distribution of people. There is a poverty component in the ethical share formula, but it only accounts for about 3% of the overall adjustment, while population accounts for close to 60%. So you will see that as populations are reduced, there's not enough of an adjuster through the population, through the poverty component to account for that. You know, and I think in my next slide, you will see that social deprivation, which is things like economic opportunity, access to opportunities, literacy, and so forth, which combine into like a multi-index social economic deprivation index, is highest in our most rural populations. These provinces also have significant infrastructure backlogs, which would deepen access to opportunities for our people. I think the current map comes out of a publication, and it's based on a multi-deprivation index developed with SAS-SA and some academics from UCT. You'll note that the areas in blue, right, are considered the most deprived regions or wards within our country. Additionally, you'll see the ones outlined in red, those represent what we would call what we used to be referred to as the homeland. And, you know, 20 years into our project and despite significant advances, it's highly problematic that the levels of deprivation still mirror the pre-liberation era. And I think we need to make sure that we improve how we deliver services to our communities, particularly in those most deprived things that you think. Focus in the Eastern Cape, KwaZulu-Natal, and then in pockets in the northern parts of the country, as well as in the Northern Cape. In the medium-term budget statement, the Minister did announce that Treasury is currently undertaking a detailed review of the equitable share, with a goal to reduce inequality and poverty across provinces. But based on like I said, I think the initial indications for the adjustments for the 2017-2018, and the fact that this process has not been in the public domain, we are particularly concerned that there may not be enough accounting for the rural context or the underserved context. And to this end, we believe or we propose that we should restart looking at a rural adjuster to counterbalance the effects of the migratory effects that may be recorded in the mid-year population estimates. This rural adjuster, you know, should include factors like a weighted relative importance that account for like increased need, demand, and cost associated with service delivery. Additionally, we propose that some of the components of the rural adjuster could look at unmet need, particularly in health. And here we say deprivation. We see proper deprivation, also that higher levels of deprivation as a proxy for unmet need. It's well documented that, you know, the poorer we are, the higher the cost is for us to actually access the health system. You know, I think there's a lot of significant out-of-pocket expenses for people that live far from health facilities. There's no patient transport and the like. And I think we have an example in one of our districts where it can cost up to like 300 or 400 rand to hire a bucket to take you to and from the clinic. Now, so even though the service is delivered at the clinic for free, the cost to get to the clinic is significantly higher. And with those levels of deprivation, income is very low. So that 400 rand becomes a very big percentage of the household's ability to survive. The second thing is obviously it needs to account for geographic remoteness. So the average distance to the metropolitan district or town could have an impact on how we allocate and obviously within the provincial sector, we can account for the number of places or small dorpies, villages, and towns that is comprised of like the Northwest, that like the Northern Cape, that like the Eastern Cape. We should also take into consideration historical circumstances. There are former homelands or farming areas where there's really been a total change of population distribution. You know, over the last while, we've seen farming communities move off farms into concentrated developments within towns, which still don't have the capacity to respond to their health needs. We also have some operational issues where people, farmers, farm workers work extraordinary times, but the farming facilities are not available during the times when they are available to visit them. You know, and then finally, we should also start looking at cost adjustment. You know, applying a rating to the cost of service delivery in non-standard areas. You know, taking consideration the difference in cost between urban and rural. The cost of building in a rural area might be lower, but the cost of getting the material there could be much higher. Right? And I think, in essence, what we're saying is that the equitable share formula, again, as the primary source of funding for our provinces, is an area that we need to have careful consideration that we don't leave anyone behind when we're making adjustments in light of some of the fiscal constraints that we're facing over the near term. When it comes to issues like primary health care, currently there is no conditional grant that ring-fences primary health care service delivery. All of that money for primary health care delivery comes from the equitable share. You know, and as provinces continue to struggle with the resource mobilization, whether through gambling taxes and the like, and the strains of providing services to our people, you know, we fear that reductions in the equitable share will lead to reduction in the allocation to allow for the delivery of district health services, which in turn, that cost don't change. You know, even our current adjustments, we're nominally increasing shares by 8% in health, it doesn't account for like the 20% inflation that there is in healthcare. So we're asking to deliver the same or even expanded sets of services with considerably less money. I think now I'd like to move into the second part of my presentation. The crisis in HR in South Africa, particularly human resources for health in South Africa is a global one, but probably more pronounced in a country like ourselves. I think we had an earlier submission to the Standing Committee on Finance, and we got a nice response from Treasury that gave us a nice table of how there's been a real growth in the number of health professionals employed in the public sector since 2008. But you know, for us the concern continues that it's the distribution of those employees that we haven't had enough information on, right? And we feel, based on our anecdotal experience and experience of our stakeholders, that rural remains underserved because they are not attractive places for in-demand professionals to go. But we issued a statement on the need to protect critical frontline posts in health, right? In response to the 2015 submission to the Appropriations Committee. Following that, we were engaged in the roundtable discussions with the National Department of Health and Treasury on developing a policy directive for the identification and protection of critical health posts. You know, I think those meetings have been ongoing and we can continue to watch the space, but we still haven't had any specific guidance coming either from the National Department of Health or from the Treasury to assist provinces during this difficult time to identify which of those posts are critical and necessary for the delivery of services to our people as we embark on the national health insurance and primary health care engineering process. You know, we further go on, we've strengthened that, and we feel that the situation hasn't changed much. And we feel that distributed cost containment doesn't always mean value for money. You know, I think in the delivery of public goods, as the honourable members and honourable chair may be well aware, we don't see the value of investments immediately. You know, so any investment that we make in healthcare, we only see that benefit maybe 5-6 years down the line. Similarly, any mistakes that we make in the allocation of resources aren't visible immediately. You know, so while we recognise the efforts of all government departments as well as the National Treasury in managing or obtained in a general cost of containment, cost containment or employee cost of compensation of employees line item. We also feel that as we move forward and when we find district value, we need to make sure that the costs don't come at a higher, that the saving doesn't come at a much higher cost. You know, some of the things that are impacting on service delivery is some of the measures that people are using for cost containment. You know, the centralizing of recruitment decisions where delegations are being taken away from hospitals and districts to employ staff. You know, these are centralized to the province, often to the office of the MEC. One, it extends lead times. And on average, the public service commission works in a 5-month estimate. So I think our friends from the fiscal and finance organization did note that while within health it is within that timeline, I think the longer it takes to fill a vacancy, the bigger of an impact it has at the service delivery level. And often sometimes those posts are even cancelled. There's also, like, maybe not an official response, but there's a tendency of not filling posts. You know, or delaying the filling of posts to realize savings. This non-filling of posts has an impact on the facility's ability to firstly deliver its services as more at least health workers have to service the same or higher catchment populations. And then it also has an impact on our ability to really meet the goals of the NHI, the primary healthcare engineering. We want to move to a more preventive approach as opposed to curative and rehabilitative, which is more expensive. So we're putting all of those investments that we're making in the reorganization of our health system at risk by indiscriminate cost containment. The minister in February in the budget statement did issue a statement to say that, you know, we should be protecting some of our frontline health posts. And he says, for example, doctors and nurses. Now, while he says for an example, and I think there's a recognition that there are other health professionals that are involved in the health system, I think without clear guidance, the system interprets that the only post that needs to be protected is doctors and nurses. While we believe that doctors and nurses are important, they don't deliver health services on their own, and they need the support of some of the associated professionals as well as some of the capacitating components. You know, like I said, in healthcare delivery, like delivery of anything, is reliant on a fully functional and efficient system. I think some of the results of the costs, or potential costs of indiscriminate cost containment, maybe a little bit more abstract and not direct. We can't say it's going to cost us 100 million or 100 billion by not investing in this. But some overstaffing or understaffing leads to diminished capacity of staff to deliver services, as they don't have the necessary equipment to maybe do the basic things. You know, these forces, you know, if we work on a process of seeing cost containment and using natural attrition processes, what happens is that as older people retire or move out of the public service, we are left with fewer senior staff. And as we've invested heavily in medical education, as these people are entering the system, there's not enough supervision because the ratio of seniors to junior staff is a lot higher and it makes it very difficult. You know, there's a weakening of the capacitating functions. Like I said, healthcare delivery is a system that relies on a number of different capacities in order to function effectively. By not defining critical, we have an underinvestment sometimes in the capacitating functions, such as procurement. You know, we know how much money we can lose by ineffective procurement based on the report by the Office of the Chief Procurement Office. You know, financial management. You know, all of us know that the large percentage of our budget is sometimes wasteful and illegal expenditure, which by and large is expenditure that hasn't followed a particular process. You know, with less financial managers, I think people are looking for ways and means to chip the system. We all know that when we are overburdened, you know, we have additional and emotional stress. And I think in a life-saving environment like healthcare, you know, I think it's important that we not underestimate. I think if we can look at it, one of the issues that we have is this medical legal claims. We've seen an uprise since the tightening of the road accident, but we've seen our legal community move towards medical legal claim. I think currently the system is provisioning for close to 18 billion rand for potential medical losses. I think in Gauteng and in Eastern Cape, some of the biggest areas, and this is an area where they're increasingly looking at. And if you look at the effects of emotional and physical strain, that leads to negligence. And negligence leads to these claims, which are becoming an increasing burden on the fiscus. And then following from that, as the Rural Health Advocacy Project, we developed in consultation with our partners a number of guidelines or proposals for guidelines we proposed national, and which ultimately we feel should spill down to help the provinces to make these difficult decisions. In the first instance, you know, we think the National Department of Health in collaboration with Treasury should provide guidance through policy on how provinces can protect critical posts at times of austerity. Secondly, we feel that critical posts need to be defined locally at the facility, and these can include health professionals and support staff. Consequences of patient care should be the determining factor on whether a post A in facility B is critical given under given circumstances. We think something that can help with this is that the districts should develop costed recruitment plans, as this will help them in that process prioritizing the distribution and important nature of posts. Now, at the moment, I think Treasury has given out the guideline that this is one of the core requirements for provinces and districts, but I think at this time we do not have any costed HR plans for health districts. When we say decision making on cost saving and cost cutting must be made at the district level, we think we need to empower or devolve some of our authorities to allow our officials to make the decisions that they mandated to do. You know, I think part of this is by giving cost saving targets to a district and allowing the district through the management process to identify how best to realize those cost savings, as opposed to without guidance. You know, I think people look at the easiest way or the low-hanging fruit. So not filling a post is maybe an easy way of saving money, but as I said earlier, maybe costs us more money down the line. Corruption and unauthorized expenditures should be performance managed. You know, so instead of going through the baby out of the bathwater, we should deal with individual circumstances, and instead of crippling the entire system by issuing a system-wide directive where good managers are also punished. I think government needs to provide guidance to the Treasury on how to exercise discretion in protecting health rights. We know under Section 27 of our Constitution, the realization of our health rights is almost a guaranteed right within means, but how that is achieved is a process that has required ongoing engagement and discussion. And thank you, Honourable Members, I've come to the end of my presentation. As I said earlier, I'm from an organization called the Rural Health Advocacy Project, where I serve as the program lead on health systems and policy. I hope that my presentation was informative, and I'm happy to answer any questions or clarify any comments. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Russell Rensberg, for the presentation. And quite very interesting also that you represent the organization Rural Health Advocacy Project. Yes, and I'll give over to honorable members just to raise questions and to, yeah, make their views. I'll start with Honorable Mutashupin, Honorable Darablash.
No.
I note all members that raised their hands.
No, thanks, Honorable Chair. Good morning, honorable members. A very fine morning today. One thing that I need to comment on is that the presentation is welcome, because views of people are always important in the eyes of public representatives. But it is also important that we must avoid an element of subjectivity in terms of our presentations. Because when you look at the presentation. It raises quite a number of critical issues indeed, but it creates a bleak picture as if there is nothing good. So I want you to strike a balance in the future, to say this is what we have seen to be best and this is the area of concern. That is what an academic does, and not only focus on one area, you see. When you come to, for an example, in your presentation, I have not marked this honorable chair. You talk of 3% of the ESF in terms of poverty and the component of that would account for 16%. When you read it, you don't know it's 3% of what, and it's 16% of what. If you could elaborate just on it. When you go to your cost containment issue, you see, filling of posts, what is critical today may not be critical after 5 years. And maybe it is perhaps the weak point of people not, you know, dealing with issues as circumstances change, to update the organogram, to say, but this is now redundant. You see. But I think it raises quite, you know, generalizations. Poor supervision of staff. It cuts across. You can't just say poor as if everything in this country is poor in terms of supervision of staff. No, but thank you. I'm not sure why it's that.
Okay, please. Are you done, Honorable Kashuping? Thank you very much. Honorable Terbas.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think that Mr. Ringsworth came up with a very interesting presentation. The one thing, you know, I think that there is consensus about the determination or the calculation of the equitable share. And obviously I know that it's not meant to be, you know, like a, you know, detailed document. It's just, you know, sort of a wide document on this issue. And I think something that will have to be taken into account is the fact that in the new formula, if we formulate or if we come up with a new formula, I think that, you know, because I see that some provinces haven't made this list, and as I said, I know it's not a detailed, you know, obviously a list. But, you know, there are similar factors, I think, in each province. If I can just cite one example, take for instance the Western Cape, that is my province now. You know, if you go to the Karoo, people are just as far from medical facilities and stuff like that. So I think we need to, when we draft or whatever this formula, we'll have to build in something that will take into account, you know, all the different issues that all the provinces can benefit equally, you know, based on the prevailing circumstances on the ground. But apart from that, I think it is a good presentation, and thank you, Mr. Van Rensburg, or Rensburg. Not Van, you are just Rensburg. Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you very much, Honorable. Honorable Lo.
Thanks, Chair, and thank you to the presenter for the presentation. It was a good one and very insightful. One of my opening remarks, Chair, and I know I'm going to sound like a broken record, but I want to put emphasis on it. And I want to say it until people hear me and are doing it. Because these presentations, we are getting it, nice recommendations, and it's good recommendations, and it's recommendations that can help, especially in the rural areas and so forth. What you are saying in your presentation of individuals having to pay 400 rand to go to a specific clinic, It's true, and people sometimes die because they don't have a foreign rent to pay the neighbor to take them to the nearest clinic or and so forth, or the nearest hospital. So I really hope that somewhere, somehow, these presentations and your recommendations are being implemented. Because we had a presentation this week of the Human Research, the Human Science Research Council, which also makes very, and have just sort of put a stamp on what you have just mentioned here today yet again, and alluded to the same recommendations and the same things that you have alluded to. We had one of the Public Service Commission, same recommendations, and they speak to more or less the same issues. So I really hope that somehow, somewhere, we can really implement some of these recommendations that academics are telling us about it, and people take extensive work to research these things, and money are going into this research. So I really hope it's being implemented in some way or somehow. My one yet again on the, I don't know the page because there's no page numbers, but on the backlogs of the infrastructure, historical backlogs of the in the infrastructure. If you look back in like in terms of Eastern Cape especially, and you made mention in some of your presentation of when we are doing this project that something should be properly cost and skilled individuals to build these roads. And when we are giving out these tenders for these roads and infrastructure, it should be given out to skilled individuals, fully skilled individuals. So we also, National Treasury also have to come in there and play a more active part in if you are not already doing so. Play a more active part in when we are issuing out these type of high skilled tenders that have to do with roads and infrastructure and so forth. So yeah, my chair is not basically quite a question. It's just to reaffirm yet again what we have heard this whole week of this academics that goes and do and commissions that go and do this research. So really, we need commitment from our side as Parliament, and commitment as well from other like National Treasury and the political world to sort of implement these research that clearly are pointing us in some way or form in a right direction. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Law, for the comment. And now, Dr. B.
Thanks, Chair. I'm going to be very brief, obviously, because this is information that we need to use. So I just have three comments on three different slides. But I'm also pleased that Mr. Rensberg is sitting close to Treasury, so I'm sure they've heard, because they don't know the main ones that would assist us in assisting them. On slide number 3, item number 3, this is a slide that deals with implementation of equitable share ways. I'm interested to see how the equitable share is allocated within provinces, and it's an interesting spread to see the highest KwaZulu-Natal 21.2% and the lowest Northern Cape of 2.6. And I understand that there's a formula used. I don't have the formula yet. I've requested it from the Minister of Finance, but it's interesting, and I see that later on in the presentation that there's an indication that there's a review of that formula. But having said that, it's just a question: why is it taking so long? I mean, it's a formula which is, you know, it's only going to be reviewed and finalized in 2018. So you know, if that could be commended, because obviously the need is immediate, and I understand there's other things that need to be considered, but just a question if there's clarification on that, and I'm not so sure, Chair, you would advise who's going to respond to that one. And then the other one, Chair, is on slide number 5, which talks about the one that says
using census data as population component is problematic. Okay, the one, the second bullet or the sub-bullet point on that page is, it says that census does not account for temporary and circular migration. Now, surely that's a difficult one to include or to consider, because, you know, how do you consider, how do you know people that are going to come there for short times, and how do you make provision for people that are going to be there on a temporary basis? So I wouldn't support something like that, even though Collinson is the one that says they should be, that should be included in the allocation. So it's just, that's just the one thing that I would probably not agree with and support. And then the other one I've covered, sorry, about the formula. Thanks, Honourable Chairperson. That's all I have today.
Thank you very much, Honourable Fit. I think on the formula, I don't know, just want to remind ourselves whether the latest review was in 2013 or 2012 by FFC, and which to a large extent was geared towards responding to the challenges faced by rural municipalities. Of course, the formula is not perfect, but I think there was an attempt to bring together FFC, SALGA, and ensure that also the calculation, how rural municipalities should develop necessary capacity to calculate in such a manner that they get empowered through the system. So it's a matter which I think together with provincial national treasurer, we'll have to ensure that that intense work is undertaken to deal with this formula, because to a large extent also it impacts on relates to areas of capacity at local government level. But let me conclude the hands that I look at. Honorable Zimande, Honorable McLaughlin, and Mayor Honorable Sinukwanyan, perfect today. Thanks. Oh, Honorable Shah, you start first. I know that you have that on coffee. Honorable Dibier, can you start?
Chairperson, just for information, the issue of the formula is being addressed also at the level of the Budget Council. So I refer us who are invited to that structure that we go and read again our documents. Secondly, Chair, in the presentations in February, March on the Division of Revenue Bill, which became an act, there's a chapter dealing with the formula. Also, the presentations that was made to provinces of the briefing on the Division of Revenue Bill. In that briefing, there was a slide or two explaining the formula, but specific in with regard to the province where the briefing was conducted. So I think it will be good if that document can be circulated again to all members to bring us on board. Lastly, about money allocations and out of the Treasury. And I made this submission at the Select Committee for Finance and Standing Committee for Finance as well. A rural province like the Northern Cape and other provinces, staff members travel from regional office to the provincial department's office, in my case in Kimberley, more than once a month, sometimes, and it's used at a huge expense. And department's chair, and we will have in our capacity as members of our committees here, in our oversight checkers, that they do it by way of video conferencing and take staff off the roads and adhere to what the Honourable Minister for Finance requested and table the measures for cost containment. It's 804 kilometres from Springbok to Kimberley. It's a day to get there, it's a day to get back, and it's a day to attend the workshop. You're out of your office for 3 days. That's not productivity. Absolutely not. And that can be done by video conferencing. All the facilities are there. We've got the technology. It must just be done, and it must be driven. I'm very serious about this matter, Chair. And lastly, on page 8 and 9, chairpersons, of the Select and Standing Committee's report on the fiscal revised fiscal framework, the inputs were captured by, which were made by Mr. Rensburg, as well as in the recommendations. We even called the Equal Education also to come today, but I see they didn't turn up. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair. Honourable Zeman.
Thank you, Chair, and also welcome the presentation and just a general question of information, Chair. The scope of operation for the project, just I don't know, it might be there in the presentation. I don't see it in my document, but yeah, just a general question for general knowledge. Then, secondly, Chair, they make recommendations in relation to looking at the defining, you know, critical posts with a view to protect them during austerity and that kind of thing. My question, which also worries us in KZN, Chair, and I hope Treasury would also provide some answers to this, is the question on rural allowances in trying to deal with staff retention and the migration thereof. If these rural allowances, there is an imbalance, Chair. What we found when we did provincial week is that rural allowances, for instance, Mzimkulu is almost 12%, and the next municipality next to in the same district, but where Bulwa is 8%, and Kokstad doesn't even have a rural allowance because it's categorized as urban. But if you look at where Kokstad is in the map and look at the movements from the Eastern Cape and KZN and Lesotho to that one hospital, which is wrongly categorized in my view, I would like to hear, you know, what would Mr. Rensburg, you know, comment, and what would be, you know, experience of rural health advance project in that regard. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Zimanda. Honourable McLogan.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I just wanted to check on slide 2, where you refer to the census 2016. Was there one in 2016? Is it 2011?
I think it was a misstatement of mine. It was mid-year population estimates that were done by Stats SA in 2016. So we have an update on the full census in 2011.
I was just wondering why no one knocked at my door. Yeah, thank you. Then if I look at slides 5 and 9, you refer to this thing that comes up a lot about the cost of delivering services in rural and sparsely populated areas. If one works on the premise that every citizen in the country is theoretically entitled to the same level of service, is every citizen of the country sort of entitled to demand a different amount from the state in order to render those services to you? Because then it becomes inequitable again. And why is it that some people have to have 200 rand spent on them to do something that costs somebody else 20 rand to do? And obviously, from a municipality's point of view, when you're in a tight situation financially, you have to serve as many people as you can for the least amount of money involved, and a few people for a great amount of money. So it becomes as a toss-up at the municipal level, and no matter how desirable it might be, they also have enormous goals to reach and things like that. And I just wonder how we're ever going to actually achieve it without some improved formula, if I can call it that. And lastly, just on your recommendations, while I applaud your recommendations, the first recommendation, decision-making on cross-cutting must be made at the district level. The comment I wrote next to this was, wow, where are you going to find people who are just so wonderful who are going to do what you suggest here? I think you have a huge belief in human nature if you think they're going to achieve this. Because while it would be wonderful, I just don't think it's very realistic personally. And then your second one, corruption and unauthorized expenses should be performance managed instead of punishing all managers. Are you still suggesting that the individual who might be responsible should have some kind of sanction? Or are you rather suggesting that should be done away with and that we have this sort of blanket kind of thing that just we don't do too much about it because it might affect service delivery in some way or another? And then lastly, Chair, I would just commend Mr. Rensburg. Of all the people who come to present here, he's the one who's been the best example of cost saving because he's here on his own. Everybody else comes with a big delegation, there are 10 people who sit there and one talks, so well done, sir.
Well, thank you very much, Honourable. Honourable Sinukonya.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair. Let me just start by saying that we appreciate the presentation and anything to do with rural services, be it health or anything. I think I always sympathize because we understand the circumstances there. But I do want to just comment on the issue of cost containment that you've mentioned. We all know that the cost containment is a current buzzword for all of us. It's not just about rural services, but everywhere. And we also understand the economy of the country doesn't allow us to do certain things that we need we would like to do. But of course, we want to have a certain bias towards the rural services. But the one thing that I just want to speak to, the issue of, you've mentioned the centralized recruitment decisions. My question would be perhaps to find out if you have explored the area of the challenges around recruitment, because experience has also shown us that it's very difficult to recruit people for rural services. It's not just about, whilst I 100% admit that the processes sometimes take very, very long and appointing people across the board, actually, not just in rural services, that sometimes it's very difficult to recruit them to go and work in the rural areas. And the issue of prioritization of medical posts, we also know that in this country we do have a shortage of doctors, and we actually do need to prioritize the recruitment of doctors, in as much as we also need to prioritize the allied workers, health professionals. But the other challenge we have with allied professionals is that we compete with the private sector. And they're actually recruited by the private sector rather than them being, I haven't done a study, but I do know that much, that a lot of them go to the private sector because of obvious reasons that they get better benefits from working there. So it's just a way of commenting that, we have a whole lot of challenges around this center. Yeah, I think some of the things that my colleagues have actually spoken to. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Member. And Honourable Gaydar waives his right to comment because he's under serious time constraints. Well, it was his birthday this week. I understand why he's rushing. So he's in a jolly mood. So then I'll allow Honourable Russell to respond.
question? Okay. Oh, he changed his mind now. I was.
Yeah, I'm more excited. One of his mothers, now discovered the truth of the matter. And I think we said it many times. Is that the budget allocation, which is done by Treasury according to census, does not really cover some of the rural provinces. You must remember, Treasury, that some of those provinces have former homelands which didn't have proper infrastructure. Secondly, when census was done, most of the people were out of the bigger city. What is worse is that during the festive seasons, those people go back to those provinces and they demand what services, and you haven't catered for them. Every festive season, they go back to their provinces and they expect services. Financially, those departments are located for them. Lastly, in some of those provinces, you've got municipalities which don't have revenue base. They don't have revenue base. It is quite true what you say, and I compliment you. It's not 400 rand, it means something 800 rand. Because there are no roads, there's no transport. That's the truth of the matter. Chairperson, you remember very well, NCOP went out to visit health facilities. One of the facilities we visited was in Maluti. And those people, that clinic catered for about 3,000 people per month. They said the worst thing that has ever happened to them is that they have to go to Mthatha, which is a referral hospital. They die on the road because it's about 300 kilos. But there's a cross border KwaZulu-Natal, which is about 100 something kilos. Those are things that need to be addressed. That's the truth of the matter. That's happening when you go down there. That's what happens when you go to the street. We stay with those people. We stay in villages. So Treasury has got to do a proper research. You need a proper research in this year. You need a proper and see if you cannot assist with the budget allocation to these municipalities who don't have a revenue base. Because they have to cater for this. But that's why these municipalities are in a bad state. They simply don't have a proper revenue base. They cannot even collect rates. There are no rates. You talk about Basha. Where are they going to get rates from? So you need to address this. Thank you. Bye.
No, thank you very much, Honorable Gila. No, you made a valuable point. You nearly left the house without really making a point. So that was a very valuable point you're making, Honorable Member.
Yes, thank you, Chair. I really want to add what the Honorable Member has now said. It actually links with what Dr. Sikker said. I'm coming from a very, very rural province. And you know, the gesture of taking the census into consideration and apply some sort of a formula to the provinces, to us, and you, if you hear any member of the provincial legislature speaking on this issue, it's actually disgusting. We do have a number of mines in our provinces. And out from what is coming out of the mines, we feel that provinces does not benefit the way it should be benefited. The biggest chunk is actually going to other and bigger provinces. So at the end of the day, the argument from Northwest is also, why don't we consider some taxation for the mining companies? Because if you are looking at the consensus compared to what is coming out of the province, we feel that we are actually running short when it comes to this allocation of funds. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Member, for the comments. Mr. Russell, can you respond, please?
Thank you, Honourable Member, Chair, and Honourable Members, for the very broad and very informative part of our democratic project. We really work in this area. And I think a lot of us in government still think that people will urbanize, right? So we should create opportunities for development and for a better life for people in urban areas. Because ultimately, people in rural areas will just move back, will move to the urban areas, right? So we feel that those populations will decrease, but I think it's far from the truth. In reality, if you look across our country, our rural communities are actually the communities we should be focusing on more. We have a big youth bulge in our rural communities, right? And if we couple that with youth unemployment, we have a recipe for social discontent if we continue to ignore rural issues, health being one of them, as a lever for development. And then, in the second instance, the role of, I advocate for the protection of health rights of rural communities, and I'm sorry if my presentation was biased to highlighting the challenges that we feel are contained, that would emanate from the implementation of what we understand the allocations in the equitable share will be. And we also recognize some of the challenges of recruiting and detaining health workers in the rural areas, and that's why we feel we need to advocate for the protection of critical posts, particularly in health in the rural areas. And then, just looking in the determination of the calculation of the equitable share, I'm not really that qualified to speak on that matter. I'll ask my colleagues to give us a better sense of the machinations behind the equitable share. I think our interest here was just to highlight that if we look at updated population estimates, that weighting impacts on all the other weightings. So the population weighting will impact on the education allocation. The population weighting will impact on the health allocation. And then to make it worse, the health allocation is also based on utilization. And then based on that, out-of-pocket expenses of sometimes going to the clinic, that's higher for the people that are most deprived. So they won't be recorded in that utilization figures that would be presented by the Department of Health. And that's why we needed to put that forward to say there are other factors to consider. Right? In terms of honorable Fick's question around how do we account for temporary month by grace? I think I was born and bred in Port Elizabeth. I grew up, in fact, in human reserve outside Port Elizabeth. And I live in Johannesburg, so I'm an economic migrant. Right? It's a term that was coined here in the Western Cape. But I return home. Right? And if I get ill or I go through maybe a major challenge, like a lot of our KZN, I think it's quite evident, and in elements of the Eastern Cape, people return home. Where they have extended families and the like to support them during times of need. You know, we probably have one of the biggest TB burdens in the world, and I think, and as well as MDR TB. And if you look where those patients are concentrated, once they get sick, there's nobody in the city to look after them. They go home to their rural communities, and we use those. So we think, maybe you can't count all the people that originate from the Eastern Cape, but is it just for the fact that the indigenous populations aren't the complete population? Well, and then, I'm sorry for my delay. And again, thank you to Honourable Member De Beer. I think I need to look at the documents of the Budget Council to also gain further insight and understanding to the machinations of government and how I was hoping some of these things are done. And then, on the, I like the use of better technologies, and I note that the Minister has made that priority to invest in government's broadband capacity, which I think is a challenge because if you look at Gauteng, maybe there was one line servicing all government departments, you know, and I think the recognition that technology is an opportunity for us to better deliver services in a more efficient manner is a good one. And I think we definitely, as a rural health advocacy project, would support that kind of thing. And then, in terms of the, I think part of the problem with the rural allowance and some of the challenges that Honourable Member Zamandi raised is that we yet don't have a consistent definition of rural. So I think different departments define rural differently. And I think it's something that we take up in the paper that we publish on working towards a generalized definition of rural. I mean, okay. I think the cost, Honourable Member McLaughlin, I think, raises interesting questions about prioritization between different communities. And I think this is an important point for us. I think there's a difference between equity or equality and equity. You know, and I think if you look at the principles of our constitution, and our goal is to improve the lives of all people in our country. And yes, maybe it costs 200 rand to deliver services in Johannesburg. But I don't think it's inequitable to spend 1,000 rand on delivering services in Harris. Right? Because as you rightly say, everybody has the same rights. And it shouldn't be impacted negatively based on where you live or what your social standing is. I think our job as advocates or as civil society, as in a compact with government and the parliament of the people, is to improve and deepen our people's ability to exercise their agency. So part of our whole advocation around the considerations that need to be taken in this approach, in the recalculation of the equitable share, is to look to ensure that the communities that are most in need are not left behind, because we have a short-term cost-containment issue. Because I believe we will get out of it. We just need to be careful that the cost-containment cuts that we make now don't cost us 10 times more in 10 years' time, when the economy rebounds. I mean, the issue of, and again, coming back to the localization, I believe that there are very capable managers within the system and across the system. I think if we take the approach that people are incapable and cannot respond to the challenges and feel that they can somehow do it centrally, I think we are the wrong way, because we're never going to build capacity. Right? And I think when I say, we don't say let's get rid of corruption, or corruption is okay. I think what we're advocating for is that corruption must be, we have very good legislation, very good guidelines. When there's a break in the system, let's performance manage the issue and not poison the whole river. Right? Because at the end of the day, that doesn't help us. If we don't have, if we have challenges in the performance management, I think it's an issue that as a nation and as a collective we can address. You know, but by just coming up with blanket solutions to a problem doesn't necessarily mean that you solve the problem. I think that in my own view, I think the delivery of public goods, as I said earlier, is one of the most challenging things, because you don't see the benefits immediately. And I think as a country like ours, I think maybe part of the national discussion should be, can we really look at the things that organize government business? If we have such high levels of wasteful and illegal expenditure, that doesn't mean that all of that expenditure is corrupt. That's illegal. Right? So should we take a step back and find out, is the system or the PFMA helping us in deliver services in an efficient and effective manner? Or are there elements that we need to adjust to our working reality so that we can better account for how we do our work? But it's an ongoing project. We are 21-year-old democracy, and I think we will only get better. And then finally, the birth of what was gone, I think the issue that he raises around the infrastructure inequity gap is something that we also raised. That the baseline that we have from 1994 was really, how can I say, privileged over urban areas and previously advantaged areas. Yes, there was a big, massive build program in the Eastern Cape to address that, but that wasn't matched all over the country. But that forms the baseline of your budget. And how we've been doing budgeting really is, we've been transformative, but we've also just an incremental spending. So we haven't made the kind of infrastructure investments that we would have liked to have made in different circumstances. But I thank the members for your comments, and I believe that we are moving forward. And I think that the things that we come to present to the portfolio committees are listened to. And I think just having it on the public record, and I think we presented to the Standing Committee on Finance, as Dr. Wodemir mentioned, and I think the responses on Treasury gave to us in the writing as a result of that submission will help us in our work as we service the needs of our community. So I don't think you'll see the results of the inputs that we make here immediately, but in the broader discussion around our country, I think all of these submissions and responses help us in doing a better job to service our communities. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Russell Ransberg, members of the two committees, Select and Standing Committee of Appropriations, have heard you and your input, and I think this is part of a process of really making inputs in the broad policy budget statement.
announcements on the budget priorities that the country will be taking. So this is quite very useful. But also, as part of this requirement, National Treasury is here with us. And I would National Treasury is not going to take to do the presentation, but at least I'll afford them an opportunity just to flag one or two issues that they'd like to flag, so that we quite very clear out of here. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much. Maybe just on a note, it wasn't just Parliament that heard the presentation. National Treasury also appreciates the presentation. So thank you very much for that. Maybe what is important in the point that you made, that this is not for the 2016 adjustment budget, it deals more with the 2017 MTF issues. And maybe what would be quite useful, I can talk the whole day about these issues, but let me try not to be too long. So if I miss something that the committee feels we should have addressed, you are more than welcome to try to answer that as well. So maybe one of the first points that we need to make is, if you look at the presentation that's been made with regard to budget cuts, that's just one of the key points that was made, is that the whole system is being reconfigured, but there's still growth in the allocations. For example, if you look at page 45 of the budget review, it actually indicates that national allocations over the 2017 MTF grows by 6.8% and provinces grow by 7.5% and local government grows the fastest by 8%. And I think that is quite important because the allocations is not really reductions. It is, but it's actually a reduction in the growth, which is a different thing than being a reduction. And I would also like to refer the committee then to page, on page 72, table T.14, which indicates the individual allocations to provinces through the provincial equitable share. If you look at that table, for example, I'll just cheat if in case it was on the top, but it was because they were mentioned as a rural province. For example, this year they're getting 58 billion rand. Next year they will be receiving 61.8 billion rand. So that clearly shows that there's not really any reductions in allocations. And if you look back through the whole table, none of them will have reductions. Maybe another key point to make is that with regard to the funding, we must also be careful to look at provincial equitable share in isolation of the conditional grants that allocate as well. Because the issue was mentioned about infrastructure, if you look at conditional grants, a large part of the infrastructure and particularly focuses on areas that is not really appropriate to deal with in the formula, but it's something that's very critical to look at, such as historical backlogs. You see that if you look at the conditional grants, it generally favors provinces with more historical backlogs. But that doesn't mean that the provincial equitable share formula does not include it. Our provincial equitable share formula works, which is different with the structure to what if you compare it against the local government equitable share formula, because they serve different types of services, it is never meant to be an allocation tool. What the provincial equitable share and the local government equitable share attempts to achieve is to ensure equitable allocations. And maybe what is quite important is that it's a wrong assumption to assume that the provincial equitable share is purely population-based. That's sort of made our lives very easy because we just assess the population versus the full population in the country and then have the allocation. And maybe what would be quite useful is if the committee, and we do this part of the general budget process, and particularly if you look at the Division of Revenue Bill, there's an explanatory memorandum that actually explains how each and every component is allocated. And it's extremely transparent because we even indicate the data that goes into the formula. And for example, the health component is most probably one of the most complex in the formula, because what it does, it consists of three sub-components And in terms of that sub-component, it actually includes information that we get from the facility. We get it from how many primary healthcare visits were done. So it is not census data, it is not population data. It's actually administrative data that comes from the respective clinics. And we've also got hospital workload. And it's just for information's sake, and this year it's on page 79 of the Division of Revenue book. But what is quite important, and a point that I've stressed in some of the provincial legislature meetings as well, the administrative data is as good as what we receive, or what the national department responsible, in this case it will be the National Department of Health, is as good as the information they receive from the clinics and from the hospitals. So what is quite important is for provinces, when they provide information to the sector departments, to ensure that it's as accurate as possible. And the same applies to education. It's got a component that in a specific day, we call it a SNAP survey, a specific day, all the children in the provincial schools get counted. And it doesn't distinguish whether you are born in this province or you're located in this province, it counts the number of scholars within the school. So it does account for cross-boundary issues as well. So another point that I think is quite important to make is that the formula is updated annually with new data. There's a difference between annual updates and what we call a policy review. You can't do a policy review every day because then the formula will never be stable and provinces and municipalities will never know what they will receive. So the general practice worldwide is to take a review of the formula every 5 to 10 years. The local government equitable share review was done in 2012. We are currently busy with the provincial equitable share formula review. And what we would appreciate as we make progress and some of those changes are being implemented, that we would like an opportunity to present the changes to the formula to this committee before it becomes part of the formal budget process so that we can debate it and make the necessary adjustments as well. Maybe another important point to make is that in this review, we're trying to include all stakeholders that's relevant. And that is also the reason why it takes more time, because we don't sit behind our desks and puzzle it out. We do it in collaboration with the provincial treasury, but more than that, we also do it in collaboration with the relevant national sector departments. So, for example, we are currently working with the National Department of Basic Education on the what we require to make changes to the education component. And another thing that we're also working with is the National Department of Health on the health component. And on both cases, what is very good, it's not there yet, but as the system of the country matures, more and more reliable information becomes available. For example, when formulas were originally developed, we had very little administrative data that we could use. Currently, the Department of Basic Education is improving the administrative data. They're replacing what we call the SNAP survey with Lurita's data, but it's still work in progress, and health is doing the same. So as the data becomes available, it will be incorporated in the formula. So over time, it will become more sophisticated. But a very critical point was also made with regard to formulas. You often need to make the decision between what you want. Do you want to be extremely complex? And then it becomes like that. The more components you include, the more dangerous it becomes, because the more you can actually then use another component that can skew the results. So for example, and what is important in that review is to see how important is that factor in impacting on service delivery. And one of the key issues, and I'm sure you would be glad to hear, is that we are looking at what do we need to do with the rural components. How do we look at it in the formula, and that will be part of the review. And we will look at it to compare, do we need to bring it into specific components of the formula, such as health, or do we bring it in as a set standalone factor, or do we include it in both? But very critical, and another point has been made, when we can incorporate data, when it's reliable and it's fair. So for example, currently what you will get is a lot of rural data, But it's so different that if you bring it in, you don't know if it's correct. And it's been just called allocation. So the data quality checks are just as important. So that is something that is also part of actually considering the process as well. Then a number of issues were also mentioned with regard to certain issues such as corruption, such as issues of rural allowances. The formula cannot, some of the issues are policy in nature that were mentioned. For example, which requires attention of the National Department of Health in certain aspects. In other cases, it needs also the decision of the provincial departments of health. For example, how provinces engineer or design their reporting systems would determine on the individual province, and how much delegation they give, for example, to a hospital or a clinic is a choice of the province, which of course needs to be informed by the policy that's set by the National Department of Health. I think what is important there is how do we take these issues forward in the right way, because not all of them are financial in nature that has been raised. I hope I've dealt with most of the issues, could I also just give over to Stephen just to give a short explanation also because some of the issues mentioned had to deal with the local government information.
Just very quickly, Chair. In the presentation was obviously on health issues, which are not local government, but several of the members raised questions around the funding of rural municipalities and own revenue bases in municipalities. And I think just to start by saying that from the Treasury side, we're very alive to the types of issues that are being presented here, the types of detail on what actually happens. And in the case of the local government equitable share formula, previous formula, so the one that we had before 2013, when we did a detailed analysis of that as part of our review process, what was quite striking was that if you looked on a per-person basis, rural municipalities got smaller allocations from that formula than urban municipalities. And when you take into account the kinds of things members are noting about the lack of an own revenue base in those rural municipalities, that was very problematic. There were good sound reasons that formula had been constructed in that way, but those outcomes, I think there was a good argument to say that those were inequitable. And so in the review process and in the new formula structure that we've introduced and that has been phased in over 5 years, this is the last year of the kind of phase-in, it has quite an aggressive revenue adjustment factor in that formula, which means that there are funds for institutional and community services that are then only allocated for rural municipalities, and that's based specifically to compensate for that lack of an ability to collect a substantial amount from property rates in those areas. So the new formula, which I think municipalities are only feeling the full impact of this year and next year, does have that kind of compensation. I should also say, just with regard to what Wendy is saying about the complexity versus the simplicity and understandability of a formula. When we did the local government equitable share formula, there were similar kinds of issues about the costs of rural services. A lot of people argued that different services in different parts of the country had very different cost structures. We went around the country on various roadshows, and I think everyone had a story about why they're... I remember in Cape Town, it was the things were so flat, that the drainage was a problem in... The Northern Cape is always the distance, in KwaZulu-Natal it's the hills. Everyone had a story about why their particular services were more expensive. SALGA and the FFC commissioned a study on the costs of municipal services that I think the members of the committee were invited to the launch of a month or two ago. That study took them 4 years to complete and present, so that's one disadvantage of the complexity. And the results from that study, I don't completely trust, I must just be frank with the committee there, but they found costs are more expensive in urban municipalities than in rural municipalities. So when you do that kind of detail, you don't necessarily come to the answer you thought. And there is an almost infinite number of methodological disputes you could have with that kind of study. So I think the structure we have in the formulas is very much geared at getting an overall citing of the case that is reasonably fair. And then I think what the presentation does is talk a lot to the kind of detail about how that money is used in the district, because that's really where you have the impact. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Treasury. I hope the Treasury is not prompting you to want to respond, Mr. Russell. Just a few minutes there. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Rabia. And I think, obviously, very informative. We didn't ever seem to suggest the population component is the only component that we worried about. We're saying that the weighting of population does influence other weighting. Right? And I think we're not saying that makes it inequitable, but that's what was drawing our attention, that we need to account for that. We recognize that you are looking at the rural components, right? And we have to obviously see a lot more of that in the public domain so that we can have an understanding of where that thinking is going. But I think over and above that, I think just in closing, we should talk about that provincial allocations and that further slicing of the cake that happens at province level. We also need some additional guidance from both tertiary, because I think the capacity of national tertiary and provincial tertiary may be different. But sometimes I think we have some inefficient allocations because of a lack of consistency. But yes, it wasn't just based on population, but rather how their population weighting impacts on other aspects.
Thank you very much, honorable members, for fruitful deliberations. And also, let's appreciate the Rural Health Advocacy Project for their input, and National Treasury for their support, and also for their valuable contributions on the work of our committee, for always sharing with us credible data that influences how government makes policy decisions. Also, our committees have a very important responsibility, honorable members, to make in-depth analysis on our own allocations and their impact in the lives of the people. So it's not just figures, but how do they translate in changing conditions of living of the people. So we take this quite very seriously, and not just as a routine, but as a very important process. Every year it takes place, there should be qualitative development. So it's quite a very important exercise. And lastly, to acknowledge the role and the support of my co-chair, chairperson of the Standing Committee, Honorable Khosa, for also allowing us to creatively fuse the program of our committees together, and that kind of cooperation also maximizes how, as the two committees and also as the select committee, can reach out to provinces in time to allow for their inputs into the process. Thanks very much. Enjoy the weekend.